As you listen to this podcast, is the air you're breathing bad for you? Our air quality in the Washington region has improved dramatically in the last 30 years, mainly because we're driving cleaner cars and getting electricity from cleaner power plants. However, there's more work to be done to ensure clean air for all residents. Safe air is not guaranteed. Unhealthy air blankets our region on average for a total of more than a week each year, almost always during hot weather. Last year, we had the highest number of bad air days in more than a decade. That's because of the smoke and airborne particles blown our way in summer from widespread wildfires in Canada. It's a concern because bad air contributes to a host of health problems, ranging from asthma to lung cancer. Here's Kristen Willard, a vice president at the Global Allergy and Airways Patient Platform, or GAP.
Let's talk first about the air quality being the worst in several years in 2023. That's a really disappointing outcome for us. We know we're not alone in this. We've got data from the World Health Organization that tells us that air pollution is the biggest environmental threat. We know it contributes to the death of 7 million people around the world.
This is Think Regionally, a monthly podcast about Washington area issues, sponsored by the Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments, or COG. One of COG's responsibilities is monitoring our region's air quality on a daily, even hourly basis, using 14 monitors placed around the region. COG sends out those color-coded alerts to warn people when the air is unhealthy and they should take precautions. Here's Jen Desimone, COG's Air Program Chief and also Managing Director of Clean Air Partners, a public-private partnership that educates the Washington and Baltimore regions about air quality.
The air quality can range anywhere from good, which is code green, moderate, code yellow, unhealthy for sensitive groups, which is code orange, unhealthy, which is code red, and then there's also a very unhealthy code purple. So COG looks at the air quality in particular when it reaches that code orange or higher. And when that happens, we issue health advisories to the public and also to the media to let them know that, hey, air quality is currently unhealthy. You know, it's time to, you know, for you to kind of adjust your plans or to take action to protect your health.
What should people do when it's a code orange or code red or, God forbid, code purple day?
So the biggest thing is when the air quality is unhealthy is everyone should know if they are sensitive to air quality, how it affects them. So if the air quality is unhealthy and they are particularly affected by air quality, then at that point in time, they may decide, okay, let's not go out for a long, strenuous run. Let's wait until the air quality improves. Let's kind of hold off on some of those strenuous outdoor activities. So that's what folks can do on a health kind of perspective.
But that's not all. When the air reaches the orange level or worse, it's important for all of us to do what we can to avoid adding to pollution.
Now, there are really simple tips that anyone can do to help reduce air pollution. And those could be things like not taking transit, biking or walking. So, you know, kind of not using their vehicles. That's one thing that can be done. Postpone mowing their lawn until air quality improves, or even better, if they have electric lawn and garden equipment, use that instead of gas-powered equipment. Also, when you're going outside and you want to grill, you want to grill out dinner for that evening, is if you have, you know, utilize an electric grill or utilize a gas grill instead of a charcoal grill. So those are just a few things that folks can do to help improve the air when it's unhealthy.
We'll hear more tips about reducing pollution later in the podcast. Because of the Canadian wildfires, our region last year had twice as many unhealthy air days, code orange or worse, than is typical.
What data shows is that on average, the Washington region can see approximately 10 unhealthy air days during the summer, with the worst air quality occurring typically in that May to August timeframe. So last year in 2023, the region had a total of 20 unhealthy air days. And of those 20 days, 17 of them were considered code orange days, which is unhealthy for sensitive groups. Three of those days were considered code red, which is unhealthy. And again, that was the highest number that we had seen since 2012.
Let's get a bit technical now and clarify what exactly is meant by dirty air. COG tracks primarily for two pollutants, ground-level ozone and fine particles. Ozone is an unhealthy gas created when car exhaust or other emissions are exposed to heat and sunlight. When breathed, ozone inflames the lungs and causes respiratory, cardiovascular, and neurological damage. The other pollutant, microscopic particulates, come from power plants, vehicle exhaust, wildfires, and other sources. They are so small, a tiny fraction the size of a human hair, that they penetrate deep into the lungs and contribute to numerous respiratory and cardiovascular diseases. Our region is currently out of compliance with federal ozone standards, which are based on measurements over a three-year period. But that's only because of the excess levels recorded during those wildfires last year. The region's state governments and the District of Columbia have asked the Environmental Protection Agency to adjust the data by exempting the ozone levels registered during the unusual wildfire event.
Oh, but we would meet the standard if those days from the wildfires were excluded, which is what you're trying to accomplish.
Exactly. So if EPA approves those days being excluded and being used in our data analysis, then that would mean that we would be meeting the standard.
So that's ozone pollution. What about the particulate pollution? What's the standard for that, and are we meeting that standard?
Yeah. So the great news is for fine particles, for PM2.5, the region is meeting that standard. EPA just recently announced a lower standard for fine particles, and the good news is again that the region is currently meeting that standard as well. So that's really great news on our part.
The other great news is the significant improvement in air quality achieved over the long term. It's evidence that changes in policy can make a difference in repairing damage to our environment.
We can go back to, you know, the 1990s, and we can see that the data has greatly, greatly improved. We previously, I would say back in the mid-ish to late 90s, we saw upwards of about 80 unhealthy air days, and we're now down to an average of 10.
How have we accomplished that?
For an example, we can tell you that looking at vehicles, the vehicles of today are much more cleaner than the vehicles of, 10, 15 plus years ago. So we're seeing fewer emissions from vehicles. They're just much more cleaner today. The same goes with emissions from power plants as well. There's been a lot of work done in particular on that, the federal level and the state level to reduce emissions from power plants.
Now let's hear how local governments are pushing forward to deepen our knowledge about air quality and how to improve it even further. The District Department of Energy and the Environment conducted a pilot project last June using state-of-the-art pollution sensors placed in cars. They drove around three communities, Ivy City, Buzzard Point, and Mayfair, to measure air quality for 2 weeks on a street-to-street basis. The results showed how much pollution levels can vary even within short distances. Now the district is about to roll out a larger version of the project, monitoring 9 communities for 3 months. Joseph Jakuta is branch chief at the D.C. Department's Air Quality Planning Branch.
think that being able to see it on the map just really makes it more salient, because you kind of know that traffic creates pollution, but when you can see that that line is so much darker than just two blocks away in a neighborhood street, I think it's really has an impact on people's ability to visualize the problem. We know through this work that probably the biggest polluter is diesel pollution. We saw it, especially in the highways, but we also saw it in neighborhoods as well. And one of the good things about having the study look at multiple pollutants is that you can tease out more easily what the source is.
What kind of compliance measures might be then considered, or what kinds of policy changes might then be considered?
Well, obviously, it's always going to depend on what the problem is. For instance, when we find an area that is an idling hotspot, we send our compliance staff out more often to inspect that area. And often, you know, it is borne fruit. For instance, we recently finished up a compliance effort against Greyhound, because they were often idling in the same spot near Union Station.
The Air Monitoring Project has focused on lower-income communities with high populations of racial minorities, which historically have suffered disproportionately from poor air quality.
Well, there certainly are instances, in particular, of highways being built through communities of color. Especially during the 1960s, you saw some communities being able to fight back against highways being constructed through their neighborhoods, and others were not so successful. And those tended to be the communities that are now considered overburdened by air pollution. There's also an increased number of facilities such as auto body shops, gas stations, stuff like that. They're still in communities that are experiencing higher levels of air pollution that were, you know, historically redlined. Then as far as how to solve that, you know, the biggest area is electrification, where DOE's funding a project actually in collaboration with COG to clean up some of the switcher trains in the Ivy City yard right now. We're also helping to fund projects, for instance, to electrify some of the DPW fleet, on the southern end of Ivy City. So electrification of these diesel vehicles is going to be crucial, because we're still going to need, you know, pickup trucks. We're still going to need garbage trucks. We're still going to need street sweepers. But as we move towards electrification, this will reduce the pollution in these neighborhoods in particular.
Now let's talk about some groups of people most at risk from bad air. One is children. Here again is Kristen Willard of the anti-allergy group GAP. She also is a board member of Clean Air Partners.
When you think in kids, they are still developing. They're still developing their immune systems. They are still growing. So, of course, they are at a higher risk of having poor outcomes related to poor air quality. We know, too, in actuality, they're closer to the ground, physically closer to the ground, where certain pollutants are just more prevalent. And their respiratory rates, when you think about it, are actually higher. So they're simply breathing more than adults do. So when they're breathing more, it's more an opportunity for them to breathe in more pollution.
Another vulnerable group is at the other end of the age spectrum.
We know the elderly are more at risk for poor outcomes. When you think about it, as we age, our bodies just are not as adept as they once were at fighting off pollutants, at fighting off threats, you know, as when we were younger.
During Code Orange days, both children and the elderly are advised to reduce strenuous exercise outdoors. On Code Red days, they should consider moving all activities indoors. The same recommendations apply to pregnant women and individuals with respiratory or cardiovascular ailments. The limitations are stricter, of course, for those rare occasions when the air quality worsens to Code Purple, or the most extreme level, Code Maroon. Whenever the quality drops to orange or below, people are also urged to pitch in to pollute less.
We also stress, adopting behaviors that are simple to do. Now, behavior change is hard for everybody, but taking simple actions, I think, really can make a change.
What sorts of things can we do? We've already mentioned using public transit or carpooling. and using electric grills and lawn equipment rather than those burning charcoal or gasoline. Willard and others also say we should fill our gasoline tanks not during the day, but after dark, when the release of fumes will cause less damage. We should reduce electric demand by turning off unneeded lights and setting the thermostat on the air conditioning a few degrees higher.
If everyone in our community made these small changes, they really, really would add up for us.
Now I'll share some of my own thoughts. We've talked a lot here about how to do better at controlling air pollution, but it's important to keep in mind that the long-term trend is one of success. Compared to 20 or 30 years ago, we have made dramatic advances in reducing the number of days each year when it's unhealthy to breathe the air. Most of this progress has been the result of legislative and policy changes at the national, state, and local levels. It shows that government regulation can work to improve conditions for the public as a whole. This is a lesson that we should apply to the greatest environmental challenge of our time, that of climate change. It's worth noting that the rise in global temperatures risks reversing the success we've had in cleaning up the air. Climate change contributed to those Canadian wildfires last year. Here's Jakuta again from the district government.
We certainly saw that last summer that climate change was leading to a major particulate matter setback for the entire East Coast. And I can't imagine that that would be the last time. Also, when it comes to ozone pollution, we know that warming temperatures will increase ozone levels. The only question is whether we can reduce the pollution fast enough to offset any increases from the increased temperatures.
It's a race against time to slow and ultimately reverse global warming. Let's remember that the stakes include the health of our lungs and heart. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast. We welcome your feedback. Email us at thinkregionally@mwcog.org. This podcast is produced by Lindsay Martin, Amanda Lau, and Steve Kanian. I'm your host, Robert McCartney, urging everyone, as always, to think regionally.